Order the Personnel Legislative and Public Affairs Subcommittee meeting for December 8th, 2015, 6:30 p.m. Before I get started, John, would you fill in for Patrick Leahy?
Me?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure. I think you're done. Notification of open meetings. We have a copy of the open meetings law posted in the back on the right-hand side. Prior to turning to the agenda for tonight's meeting, I would like to announce the procedure that will be used for this meeting. With respect to each agenda item, the directors will first hear staff proposals and recommendations. Then the public will be given the opportunity to speak to the item. Lastly, the directors will discuss the item and take action, and we ask that the public not interrupt the direct discussion and action. Thank you very much. Quorum call.
Connolly.
Here. Here. I think you called me.
Sorry. No problem.
Fowler?
Here.
Bonet? Yep.
Yes.
And Connolly-Tott?
Here.
Item number four, adoption of agenda.
So moved. Second.
My motion is second. Roll call.
Fred Connolly?
Aye.
Fowler?
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
John Connolly?
Yes.
Item number five, proof of publication and of meeting notice. Item number six, review and recommendation on the 2016 pay program administration manual. Gene Tate.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Seems like we just did this a few months ago. Well, December is the month that we review the pay administration manual. And we make changes and bring forth considerations to the district's pay structure, the merit increase matrix, which is used to determine the pay increases through the evaluation process, cost of living adjustments, and other administrative changes. Every 4 or 5 years, the district works with Silverstone Group to review each of the job descriptions so that we can make sure that we're paying the market, the current market value for each position. The market analysis was last conducted in 2013, and adjustments were made to the pay structure at that time. This year, the only changes to the pay program are updates to the document date and review date. Silverstone's compensation planning for 2016 projected the average merit increase at 3%. The average combined merit increase for district employees for 2015 was 2.66%. No change to the pay structure or merit matrix chart is recommended, and there is no cost of living adjustment for this year. A red line version of the policy manual is in your books, and I will entertain any questions you might have.
Anyone from the public wish to speak to this item? Directors? Okay, roll call.
We need a motion.
Sorry.
A motion to accept staff recommendation.
Okay. Got a motion to accept staff recommendation?
Second.
Roll call.
Fred Connolly?
Aye.
Fowler?
Yes.
Yep.
No.
And Johnson?
Yes.
I think we're adjourned. Hey, John. I'm going to have to leave. I'm going to have to leave.
Thank you. Oh, okay, yeah. I'll get somebody. Thank you. I'm in my You want to serve on the next one? Okay.
Are you going to go?
Oh, yeah, that's where you're going. Okay.
I'm going to make that announcement. Just the same, John.
Yeah. Lori? Tim Fowler is going to replace Fred Connolly on the PPO committee. Okay. Calling to order the programs, projects, and operations subcommittee December 8th at roughly 6:35. A copy of the Open Meeting Act is posted outside the door to this room. As far as items on tonight's agenda, we'll first hear staff recommendation. We'll ask for a motion to be placed on the table. We'll ask for public comment, and then we'll have directors' discussion and voting, and we ask the public not to interrupt the directors' voting and discussion. With that, quorum call, please.
Fred Conley?
Lady?
Caesar?
Here.
Thompson?
Here.
Fowler?
Here.
And Johnson?
Here. Do you know what this, Mr. Winkler, you know the status?
Mr. Leahy had an excused absence.
It doesn't show here. Okay. Mr. Thompson, would you fill in for Patrick Leahy? Well, you're already on here. Let's get Mr. Bont. Would you fill in for Patrick Leahy tonight on this committee?
I would. Thank you.
Thank you. Got that, Lori?
Yes.
Okay. Now moving to item four, the adoption of the agenda.
So moved.
Second. Roll call.
Caesar?
Yes.
Thompson?
Yes.
Fowler?
Yes.
Burnett?
Yes.
And
Shepard? Yes. I have here an affidavit of proof of publication of the notice of tonight's meeting, and that will become part of the permanent records. Moving now to item six is a review and recommendation on the West Papio Trail. This is HGM Associates contract for additional construction administration services. Eric Williams, please.
Good evening. John Krager from HGM is with me this evening.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks.
This recommendation is about the West Papio Trail extension from about 90th Street to about 108th and Giles. That project was designed and constructed during 2015 and opened on August 24th for public use. There were a couple of items that occurred during the original design, the construction, and then the closeout prior to the opening of the trail that need to be addressed. And the HGM's request is for the fee related to those services. The first items listed as Exhibit A in the memo occurred during the design. There was a low-flow crossing listed as WW3 and a traffic signal relocation. Those two items, the additional fee was requested by HGM. Marlon and I reviewed those and sent an email response verifying that we did want those services to be completed. HGM proceeded with that design work, and that work was included in the plan set. During construction, listed as Exhibit B here, there was weather-related delay in the construction, which caused additional services for SWIP inspections and material testing to be required from HGM. And they submitted a written Appendix K, which is an amendment to the original contract, and the total amount of $14,257.35. At that time, the previous two items, the low-flow crossing and the traffic signal relocation, were not listed as part of a previous amendment. So what's listed as Exhibit B and was reviewed and approved as Amendment Number 1 was just for that $14,257.35. It did not include the previous dollar amount. So on both sides, we had agreed to have those services contracted. The services were completed, but it was not included in the amendment that was signed, listed as Exhibit B here in the memo. Exhibit C is the documentation for the additional services during construction observation. The deadline for the completion of the trail was originally by July 1st to be done in FY 2015. Again, due to some rain and delay there, the project was moved to the project construction deadline was moved to August 1st. After August 1st, there were some remaining items, essentially a punch list of items to be completed prior to the opening, the ribbon cutting, and the public ceremony for the trail on August 24th. So HGM staff was in the field doing observation as the contractor was completing those remaining items. And the total amount of the hours expended by HGM was $4,169.20. So the total in additional services on top of the initial contract is $23,126.55. Of that, the Exhibit B portion was listed as Amendment 1 and was reviewed and approved by management up to the 10% management approval limit and signed. The Exhibit A portion and the Exhibit C portion were not included in a final amendment that was reviewed and signed by both HGM and the district. And so the recommendation is to authorize another amendment to this contract in the amount of $8,869.20, covering the Exhibit A and Exhibit C services that were provided by HGM, and bringing the total maximum not to exceed amount of the contract to $167,472.49.
What's your pleasure with this item?
Move the staff recommendation.
Is there a second?
Second.
We have a second. Anyone in the public wish to speak to this? Seeing none, directors? Director Thompson.
You talked about the punch list a minute ago. Is that part of the $8,800?
So the construction portion of the punch list, there were no additional fees. That was work that needed to be essentially corrected after the August 1st deadline, but before the opening. However, that meant that HGM did do additional construction observation after the project completion deadline, the substantial completion prior to the opening. And so those additional services from the consultant for the observation were on top of their contract. It was not expected that they would be doing, I think it's 73 hours of additional final review in those last 3 weeks leading up to the opening. But the construction portion, the contractor took care of that, and there was no change order on any of that additional work.
Did I answer that for you, Jim? Director Teaser?
So basically, because of some rain delays, we're getting back to $4,100, right?
Yes, and the and then again, as Director Thompson just pointed out, the additional services from the engineer during the punch list correction portion. And so we did not have a change order from the contractor for that additional work, but the engineer did need to complete additional construction observation. So those two things are basically what the additional fee is here.
It kind of bothers me that we have a $168,000 contract and coming back in one portion asking for $4,000 because we ran over due to weather. Seems to me that you've got some of this filled in. I personally am not happy about it, I would take this in consideration in the future contract that you might want to bid on. But this just wants to know that.
Director Japp.
Well, I understand the rain delay that all the contractors had to deal with this year. But if there wasn't any rain delay, you still would have, the project would have got completed on time, and there would have been no additional surface charges from the engineering firm for inspection. And you weren't doing any inspection when there was no contractor working. So there wasn't no additional time that you had to put in. It was just your time got extended. Isn't that correct?
Our time did get extended because of the rain delays. There was some additional work that the contractor did in order to get a lot of the compaction and get their work completed. It was just extending our time out there on the site from what we originally expected to be out there for. Our original contract was only for about 60 calendar days, and that was until July 1. And then this got extended into August 1st, and then past August 1st to August 24th. So we had an original contract time of only 60 calendar days. And that the contract start was, I'd have to look, but the contract start was sometime in March.
Yeah. The calendar days I'm not concerned about. It was the time you spent out there. You would have spent the same amount of time out there. So therefore, you're asking for more money for time you didn't spend there.
So during the rain delay, there were additional services that were not expected from HGM, and that was for SWIP inspections. There was some additional disking and then recompaction testing of particularly the soil underneath the 96th Street Bridge. As construction had already started, the rain came down, pooled under the bridge, made that soil much wetter than it was expected would have happened. And so there was additional material testing and stormwater inspections needed from the consultants, even though the contractor was not working on site. So there was no additional contractor work, but additional work from AGM.
I spent many hours on construction sites this year, and not one engineering firm or testing firm asked for more time. We all had the same problem. I don't know why we're different here today.
I'd like an explanation of why we're asking for extra money for punch list items. That should be normally an item associated with most general
contracts.
Yeah,
there's no additional cost for the punch list items. Those were items that are being covered that were part of the original contract.
They should have been. Yeah.
They were.
But they were mentioned earlier, so it sounds like it gave me the impression that that was part of your justification for these.
It was the time spent as the contractor was trying to complete the punch list of items. So there were several things that were after the August 1st date, which was substantial completion time, that the contractor was out there trying to finish his work, which included some fine grading, erosion matting and seeding, fixing some of the fence lines that were out at the site, cleaning up the site so that we could have the August 24th opening.
Any other questions or comments? Roll call on the motion, please.
Fowler?
Yes.
Burnett?
Yes.
Caesar?
No.
Thompson?
Yes.
And Shippers?
Yes. Report to vote, please.
A 4 yea, 1 nay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, moving to item 7, review and recommendation on renewal of the USGS maintenance agreement for the Papio flood warning system gauges. Amanda Grant, please.
Hi, good evening.
Hi.
Well, each year we revisit the contract with the USGS. This would be our fourth year that we have considered an agreement with them for maintenance of the Papio system flood warning. The flood warning system. It does also include a gauge on Omaha Creek at Homer, which is outside of the watershed. And then this year, it had been in a separate agreement. It was a groundwater well at Waterloo, so it was part of a groundwater surface water interaction system. But since it's basically for the surface water, you know, from that interaction, it was included this year into the contract. So if you remember, we have 22. Gauges, 17 report rain and stage, and 5 report rain only. And then we have that additional well at Waterloo that I mentioned. So the map of the sites is attached along with the agreement, the proposed agreement from the USGS. And the numbers for this year, the contribution from the district would be $119,810, which is up a little bit, a couple thousand dollars from last year's contribution. The USGS portion that they pay in is also up a couple thousand dollars. They use two different kind of pots of money to put, you know, to put towards from their end, but the total of that is $33,350. And just to let you know a little bit of that's gone on throughout this year. So this system was put in place in 1993. And in 2012, we updated with a lot of new equipment. But the transmission portions, some of those components are still there, and they're from the 90s. And so that's an issue that we know we've been dealing with and we're working to maybe replace over time. But we had a few sites that had some transmission issues this year. The USGS went in and put in their own equipment at their cost and are keeping things running and trying some different ways to transmit that data to see the best way that we can do that. We meet with the National Weather Service and the USGS several times a year. We're always talking about improving our system, making it more available to the public, and I guess if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. I did attach this year a couple of documents that show a little more detail of what we get for our money and what they do at each gauge site. And so if you, some good reading, if you want to read through that, they do a lot of tasks at each of the sites, and then they also spend a lot of time quality assuring that data and posting it for use for public for many different reasons. And their fact sheet had a really good description, I thought, of that. So if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay, first of all, the chair would entertain a motion on this item.
I'll move for staff recommendation.
Do we have a second?
Second.
Okay, I have a second. Anyone in the public who wish to speak to the item? Directors? Director Thompson.
Thank you. There's a nice attachment here, and as far as the station numbers, station name, pull them off to reach ring gauge and plug in. I mean, you have any idea how they come up with those dollar amounts?
Yeah.
It adds up to $157,000, $53,000. But how, again, it's a significant contract.
Yeah. So, you know, we do know. And so the tasks, basically their fact sheet lays out, you know, like say 40, about 40% of the cost at each gauge is labor. And another 10%, you know, it kind of goes through in a percentage thing. We don't do hours or anything for them, but they have provided this information on a percentage basis. And if you'll know, each gauge, the gauges are different. Some of them, they collect discharge data, which means they come out during high rain events with their equipment and they're measuring discharge. Some they don't. So
we just reviewed an amendment to a contract. It had great analysis of number of hours by engineer, by so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Why not USGS? Why do we do it for private sector engineering firm? But somehow, there's USGS again asking for money that we don't know how they come up with the dollars. And I appreciate percentage. I appreciate the numbers, time, and all that. But do you have any idea how it's based on per hour?
I do, and I talked with them.
Annual salary of one employee and so on? I mean, that's...
You know, I don't know that, but I did know that that's been a concern over the years, and I talked to him about it. This is the stream gauge system is a network, and so it is a set rate for each gauge across the state. So I know
USGS?
That by USGS. And okay, so that's how they set that number. I would suspect we get the benefit of that because we have a lot of – we use different equipment than what they're used to. And we have, again, I mentioned that older transmission. So they do spend a lot of time on our gauges. So I suspect we would get the benefit of that.
In essence, a retail price list that they go by in a sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Other questions? Yeah, Director Patrick.
How do we know if any of these gauges are set up with telemetry equipment?
So how it works is they all have radios in them, and then the and this was another thing we changed, are in the process of changing this year, but all of the sites shoot either directly to the National Weather Service in Valley or to a repeater that's up kind of at Hummel Park up on a hill there, and then get sent to the Weather Service. And then at the Weather Service, we have a computer there that has a particular software that collects the data, sends it out to the Weather Service and to USGS. That software's no longer being supported. It's very old. So this year we're changing out to it'll collect the data still at the Weather Service with just like a decoder box and send it directly to we use a company called Contrail that has servers in Colorado, and they'll store the data, shoot it back to us from there.
One of the things I'm kind of concerned about is the number of man hours and the cost of labor over the last few years that we've seen some of this equipment decrease a lot, decrease the needs for the number of trips and the number of hours out.
Absolutely.
Are we looking into that?
Yeah.
Retrofitting the gauges wells that we have out?
We are. So we have three that the USGS has installed their equipment on now, and they use a satellite rather than a radio transmission. So we've always had a little concern about the real-time data. I mean, it can collect data as quickly as we want it to, but can it transmit it as fast as the radios? So we're going to pretty quickly get out of my area of expertise. Mm-hmm. But the satellites, we believe, can handle that, in the 1 to 5 minute range that we're used to seeing data. So we're testing three sites now, and I think that should work the way we want it to. And if it does, it's a much more reliable system and would be much better and also more familiar to the USGS because that's what they use everywhere else.
And it's just a balance of cost of the new equipment and getting those installed.
Right.
And you know, the little bit of history, before the USGS took the system over, the reliability was horrible. The maintenance was horrible. The expense was horrible. And so we can't do this for what they do it for us. I mean, it's just not possible.
So they do us a service by being a part of the system and not only bringing the expertise but the equipment and all that with them. So, it's one of those things that you balance all that upfront cost of the technology with what benefit do you get at the end. So I think
right.
We're looking at it and seeing if that's, in fact, we're getting that big of a benefit before we make those huge expenditures.
Right, and the system still works. It's just older. That's why we kept it. But
I've got two questions for you, Amanda.
Sure.
One, what is the turnaround time for real-time data from the time it's collected to the time it goes out to, you said, Colorado and gets back to the local weather bureau?
We're thinking probably 5 minutes.
Really? That's amazing.
So it can collect it every minute. So when you go to a site, you know, you physically plug into those radios, you can pull all that even faster. But we do see some delays now. I mean, we see the data comes in on, it gets, comes in, it goes to the Weather Service, it goes to USGS, and it goes to this computer we have. So we have all these different places that the data is coming in, and it is faster in some than others. But what we want to see in our goal and what we have seen through this Contrail, the system we use, is a 5 minute.
That's great. Yeah. That, my second question relates to the use of satellites. I think my limited understanding of satellites is that there's a lot of interference when there's clouds. And that's usually clouds and storms go together. And have those proven successful?
You know, that's I think that is not true. And I think that the way that they're set up and the way that's been explained to me is, so they can collect data very quickly, and then each transmitter has a set time that it sends data. So, you know, in non-storm events, maybe it sends it every 10, 20 minutes, half hour. Mm-hmm. But when the creek gets to a certain stage, you want it to start coming every minute or 5 minutes or however you set that. So I think what I've heard, and I think we found a way around the problem, but I think if you have a whole bunch of sites that are going all the time, there could be some cross interference. You still always have the data because you can physically log in, pull it. But as far as transmission, and that's one reason why we were a little hesitant to go that route in the first place. But I think that I don't think it's as big of a problem as we think it might be.
That's good. It's only your DirecTV or
It's only direct. That yeah. only works. It's yeah. okay going up. It's not good coming down. Okay. No, I don't believe it. Any other questions or comments? Roll call on the motion, please.
Burnett?
Yes.
Keyser?
Yes.
Thompson?
Yes.
Fowler?
Yes.
Shepherd?
Yes. Thank you. Next item then is item 8, review and recommendation on the Water Sustainability Fund application for the West Bay and Regional Basins WP6 and WP7. That's Amanda Grant again.
Yeah. Oh, here's my memo. Short one this time. So for your consideration, we would ask that the subcommittee recommend to the board to submit an application to the Water Sustainability Fund to help fund 60% of the eligible costs for WP 6 and 7. And maybe, Bill, can we go to the map? Or Mike, can we go just quickly? But the plan, we're still working on this application. The submittals are due December 16th through December 30th, and so we're still working to get everything. 15th through the 30th? Okay, so we're working to get everything pulled together for this application. But the plan we have right now, we will take WP5, so Prairie Queen, WP6 and 7 as a system and present that as a project to the Water Sustainability Fund and then ask just for eligible costs on 6 and 7 since we've already constructed 5. So that would be, you know, we have estimates of cost right now, which are around $13 million for the construction and design of 6 and 7, so it would be maybe around an $8 million application.
Okay, thank you. Chair would entertain a motion.
Move with staff recommendation.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Anyone in the public wish to speak to the item? Seeing none, directors? Roll call.
Caesar?
Yes.
Thompson?
Yes.
Fowler?
Yes.
Burnett?
Yes.
Chairperson?
Yes. Now, item 9 is review and recommendation on the Water Sustainability Fund application for the modification of the Missouri River Levee Systems R613 and 616. Paul Woodward and Mike Sotak with FIRA. You don't look like Mike.
No, no. I think we included Mike and then forgot to tell him to come. Good evening. It's kind of a continuation of what was reviewed last month, mostly by John, going over the local cost share that's expected from the cities of Bellevue and Omaha and Sarpy County, and then what the district's contribution to the project may eventually be there at $5 million. This is directed then to submit a water sustainability fund for 60% of the eligible costs, as Amanda just reviewed, for the entire $25 million that's expected to include the construction, the engineering, the oversight during construction, basically getting us through the whole kit and caboodle of getting this project completed. Right now, they are continuing to work on that entire application package, specifically focusing on some of the benefit cost analysis that's required for the levies. So that is ongoing, but we're asking tonight for your review and approval of submitting this application. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Chair would entertain a motion on this item.
Move that motion. That's written here.
Thank you. Is there a second?
Second.
We have a second. Director Fowler. Anyone in the public wish to speak? Directors? Director Thompson?
I stand corrected. It's December 16th through the 30th. They will accept applications.
Okay.
I know the 15th was the day before, so hey.
Paul, is there any risk that we will not get these applications in the time frame required?
No, we can't not meet that deadline. So
will meet the deadline.
We will meet that deadline.
We will
yes.
meet the deadline. All right.
This is a pretty important.
Director Jack.
After the applications are sent in, when is their expected approval?
It's fairly unknown a little bit more, but April is expected. We are expected to know by then, with maybe not a formal obligation of funds. And then, you know, I think expected you could probably start working on your project the way they have the application laid out by, like, our next budget year, July 1st.
The city council passed the MOU on consent agenda this afternoon, 2 o'clock, so everyone signed up.
Good. Thank you. Let's see. You want to go again?
If I might add, Paul's correct. April is the anticipated date for an ad hoc committee to review all the applications with the full commission meeting probably in June to rate and rank all applications, and then the sponsors will be notified accordingly.
And what will you be sitting in on those?
I'm not on the ad hoc committee.
Okay. Any other questions? Director Bonnet.
So the Water Sustainability Fund has a maximum of 60% cost share, is that correct?
No.
Was this the only fund, maybe direct investments I hear, but was this the only one of the six consolidated funds that we can apply to for this particular project?
Correct.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Roll call on the motion, please.
Thompson?
Yes.
Fowler?
Yes.
Burnett?
Yes.
Heiser?
Yes.
Chairperson?
Yes. Now moving to item 10 is another review and recommendation on water sustainability fund application and MDR Insight Data Enhancement Program application for the Platte and Elkhorn River Valley. This is an integrated monitoring project. Paul?
All right. Good evening again. I do have with me Chris Hobsa. He's with the U.S. Geological Survey. We'll try to go through this as quickly as can. I have a lot of background written there. Basically, we've looked at this area with some questions from the Lower Platte Basin Coalition as to, let's say someday we're working towards meeting flows in the river during times of very low flow for what's needed for the municipal well fields or for the in-stream flows for habitat in the Lower Platte. And we come up with these great projects that somehow are holding water upstream and release it when it's needed, or are holding water in the groundwater upstream and are releasing it That additional water that is actually coming down the Platte River, there are questions as to what might happen to it. There are some losses that occur as you go along the Platte, and I think one of the main questions that people have asked based on a study that was conducted by Lower Platte North NRD, in which UNL actually looked at the bed and bank of the Platte River around the North Bend to Fremont and then around by Valley in several locations, and found that was actually based on the pressures they found in the water and the permeability of the soils along the river could pretty easily transmit water through those soils, and it was probably doing so. So water was being lost out of the Platte River to the aquifer. The question that's come up is from there, we don't know really what's happening to it. It's not lost, but when does it get back to a river or a stream? Or is it just in storage there in the alluvial aquifer? So those are the kind of questions we're hoping to ask. So what was done was we did consult with USGS to put together a proposal on looking at this. The actions that were are described here are looking at, maybe go down to the map, Mike, it's on the first figure there. Kind of the whole area is a study area, but in particular I want to point out that green line. There are stream gauges at both of those locations on the Platte River on the west and the Elkhorn River on the east at Waterloo. And so what we would be able to do is relate different flows in the river to how they react then with elevations in the groundwater. We're looking at five different actually monitoring wells across there, and like the flood warning gauges we just talked about, they will be real time. They'll be sending data constantly back and forth, and so we'll be able to make sure that they're working correctly. That's one of the big advantages of being able to see that real time. So if something did go awry, you're not missing weeks or months of data. We're looking at this over a two-year period. So that was a component of that, is installing continuous recorders, so continuously monitor the groundwater, and then approximately every 15 minutes they'll relay that information back and forth. From that, I guess, and Chris is here to answer any of the other questions, there are some other components to the study that we wanted to do. So within the entire study area, we looked at doing specific, so this is a lot more than five, going to different wells and taking groundwater level readings at specific times during the year, at least a couple of those surveys over the two-year study, and then completing contour maps. Where's that groundwater leading to, and what's it doing on a bigger stretch than just that single line? That would fit in. And then similar to the bed and bank conductance, the study I talked about that Lower Platte North did on the Platte, we would do something similar to that on the Elkhorn near the Waterloo gauge site there. So see how the soils on the Elkhorn bed and bank can receive that water potentially, and you know what might be interferences to doing that. Maybe go to the next figure real quick. I'll show you the difference between why we think this is probably kind of a natural retiming system, and maybe just flip that counterclockwise, no, clockwise. There you go. Okay, so on the left of the page is the Platte River, and on the right of the page is the Elkhorn River along that same line. And in fact, it seems very flat in that 9-mile stretch between the two rivers, but there's about a 30-foot drop in elevation between the two rivers. So we're expecting to try to find out not exactly how long water that leaves the Platte takes to travel to Elkhorn, but how long before the grades change in the groundwater between the two, and what does that mean for potentially more water, increased flow in the Elkhorn River. And the Elkhorn River does flow down past near the MUD well fields, but also directly past Lincoln's well field. So the costs are shown, may go back up to the memo there, broken out by activity. got to go around the horn here. Hold on. Right at the top of the page there. So the actual equipment, recorders, and then actually going out and installing those and then monitoring them, keeping them working over the two-year time frame. The water level survey and interpretation of that into like the contour maps I described. Permeameter study on the river, the bed and bank conductance there. And then finishing everything up with the maps and interpretive report. So how we get to a total project cost of $245,000, looking at getting some outside funding for that was an opportune time here. We did have a solicitation from the Nebraska Department of Natural Resources, a little bit different than the Water Sustainability Fund, but we're looking at this specific type of information to help support their knowledge base as they look at the fully appropriated basin status. And also as they help calibrate some of their groundwater models, which are being developed for this particular area. The second fund you'll see there described is the Water Sustainability Fund. So after we look at receiving USGS's match of $66,000, and then the NDNR proposed application was for $72,000. We should hear in January if we receive those funds. But then the remaining 60% would go towards the Water Sustainability Fund, and then a 50-50 cost share match between us and Lower Platte North NRD. Lower Platte North did review this at their water committee last week, and it was approved and moved on to their board meeting next week. Just as a approval for the application, we would still need a final interlocal agreement once we determine we have the funding. So that's it. We'd be happy to go over any questions or any other details if you like.
Let's see if we get a motion on the floor so we know what we're discussing. Anyone care to make a motion?
I'll make a motion.
Motion by Director Teaser. Did I hear a second?
Second.
Second by Director Fowler. Anyone in the public wish to speak to this? Seeing none, directors? Director Teaser.
Paul, you said there would be one additional monitoring well that will go in. Will that be by the 64 bridge? Or?
Yeah, so the only new well we'd have to drill as part of that work would be by the 64 bridge. And the reason to put a brand new one in there is so we can already use the equipment that's there at the stream gauge. It's actually cheaper to drill the well than to buy the new.
So that'll be on our property?
Yes. Yep.
At the Platte River Landing.
Yeah, that Platte River Landing. And then from the map, you can see there was the other gauges or the other wells actually exist. They don't have these real time or continuous monitors on them. But one's owned by Lower Platte North. One's actually owned by MUD. We do have a letter of support and cooperation from them. And then one is still. Actually, USGS monitoring gauge that was there and is not currently in use, but we can certainly put it to good use here.
I'm just curious, will the public have access to this? Live?
To the entire data set?
Yeah.
Yeah, they will. It'll all be live. Actually, right now, what Amanda described on the Waterloo gauge, you can go there and see groundwater levels versus stream levels. And so they'll see that same thing for these different sites. And then at the end, it'll all be a public report.
Another question. I see another hand. Another director. Director Bonnet.
I noticed you didn't include a topographic here. We already have the area. Let's see. We're gathering a lot of data. And for this particular project in this area, what's the purpose of it? Specifically, what are you hoping to accomplish with this data? We all know that it's a low-lying area. It's high water table, farmland out there.
Yeah, I think I'll just review a bit and maybe just Chris can follow up. But I believe what we'll learn is that flows that come down the Platte River, if they are kind of lost out of the river into the alluvial aquifer, we'll learn how they cause water to maybe move out of that aquifer into, you know, if the water goes up, more water is going to move out into the Elkhorn River. And that would be very important to know the timing of that and the potential amount, because you know, you get down to times of really low flow, that could be desperately needed to know when you might see that water return to the well fields or to the in-stream flows down by the lower gauges at Ashland and Lewisville. I think anything else to add to that, Chris?
Oh, I just, you know, the first thing we
did. Let me stop you just a minute, please. Would you give your name and association for the recording that we're making, please?
Absolutely. My name is Chris Obza. I'm a hydrologist with the USGS and the Nebraska Water Science Center.
Thank you.
So one of the things when Paul and I were first discussing this project about a month and a half or 2 months ago, we started looking at some of the historical data. I know we had a lot of, you know, with MUD and City of Lincoln, there's a lot of data that are in that particular area. We started looking at not just the water level, the groundwater level data, but also the stream stage data. So looking at how high the river is on the Waterloo gauge and also the LaShera gauge. And one thing that we noticed as you start to plot different stages in the stream, that changes the groundwater levels quite a bit within that area. So there's a lot of things going on that we don't really have a good handle on right now. So just because the Platte's high and say the Elkhorn's low doesn't mean that groundwater is going to flow in one static direction. There's a lot of other influences that we've with this study, we'll hopefully tease out.
I think MUD is planning to put more of a load on their Platte West plant because of improvements and upgrades to their Florence plant now that they've got extra capacity. So if, in fact, they do change what is their normal, so to speak, scenario of producing water from the well field out there, how will that impact your study?
Well, I did talk with MUD on this, and the monitoring gauge that we're using of theirs is their very north monitoring gauge. So we're relatively far enough away from the well field, we shouldn't see a lot of influence from their wells. Now, there certainly are things during different times of year that can affect our study area a little bit, but they won't be nearly as, you know, as big as the MUD well field. So,
and this will be a long-term study, not just a snapshot in the summer.
It'll be over the full 2 years that we've discussed, and we might, you know, we have the one Waterloo gauge there right now. We might continue to look at keeping one or two of these gauges if it seems like that's necessary.
Thank you, Director Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, what you said, you're going to determine how much groundwater, how long it takes to get from one point to another.
Oh, yeah, see the reaction that occurs between them. Yep.
Then what happens?
Then we can use that information to, let's say we did have a proposed conjunctive management project that sent water either down the Platte or the Elkhorn River. We would know what might happen to that water as it tries to reach the low end.
Conjunctive water program, I mean, some more dams upstream or what?
That could be something to release there, or more recharge projects upstream that are putting water into the groundwater specifically to come back to the stream at a certain time. So the whole idea is can we manipulate the system a little bit to either keep the water that we want to get there in July and August during the dry period to stay in the river, or could we actually use this whole system the way it works? Let's say water comes down in the spring. Maybe it is just about the right time that, you know, water released in late May will have an influence on water going into the Elkhorn in July. And that would be something we could utilize then to try to keep water in the river.
Okay, but that's where I'm at. Try to keep water in the winter in the river. How and what are the projects? I mean, the time it takes to create a project for us or anyone is by then the water is either drought or gone or who knows what. Another rainstorm comes. And, you know, I guess it's fine to have data, but you know, what do you do with it? If you say, okay, remember the study we did in 2016, that said, or 17 in this case, that said, you know, we should probably put a dam up there because of the study. I don't know. Is that kind of where this whole pile of data sits?
Maybe you want to try to
let me get my little thought on what we're doing here is, yes, we're looking through this Lower Platte Basin study on putting in projects that will retime the water in the whole basin and get it to where you need it when you need it. And one of the main things we have is our Lincoln and MED well fields. You need water there on July 31st. How are you going to get it there if we have a drought? And the way you do it is we're looking at, through this plan, Director Bonnet was at the basin meeting that we had in Mahoney Park, that said we're looking at different projects. And maybe one of them is a dam in the Lower Platte North NRD over on Skull Creek. And you put water in the river and in that dam and you release it to the Platte River. My question is it ever going to get to the well field? And I think what we're studying here is saying we know there's a losing part of the Platte River that's losing water from the Platte to the Elkhorn. We put water in the Platte. Is it going to make it down to the MED well field? This will help us determine that and put the numbers in the model that tell us what happens to that water that we put in the Platte up here before it gets to the well field. And that's one of the simple, I think, things that we'll find out.
And
bringing
MUD in the discussion and the need to protect that water or that well, I would assume they had already either done some analysis on that or with the investment of $250 million, maybe John knows the exact number.
I don't think they've done studies of this, what the losing parts of the Platte River are and really where that water goes.
They hadn't before they designed the plant.
Well, they looked at what's coming down the river at their well field.
The whole valley was modeled.
Oh, sure. But I don't know. But those models also have a lot of generalities. This is a detail that's not in those models.
Right.
Nobody's got that. That's why DNR is interested in getting it in the model, because they don't have it in their model either. It's part of a river dynamic part. But I think these are things that really help to create an integrated water plan of surface and groundwater, and that's what we're looking at, the way they interact together and how ultimately this whole management of this whole Lower Platte Basin is going to evolve.
Okay, one other question.
Sure, go ahead.
The motion that we're discussing talks about getting inside funding from DNR and submitting application Water Sustainability Fund. If we get funding on the $72,000, but we don't get funding from Water Sustainability Fund, then what happens? And finally, what happens after 2 years when this is done? I mean, is it all the way the motion is dependent on getting some money from Water Sustainability Fund? Are you anticipating coming back to this board if it gets rejected?
We do have to come back and at least provide the different agreements. I guess at that time we would probably discuss whether there's maybe parts of the study that we wouldn't have to do to complete everything. We could still get the real-time recording and the water level surveys and maybe not do the bed and bank information in the Elkhorn River. Or something along those lines. I'm just saying, keep it equitable for us and for Lower Platte North NRD, but still get something worthwhile out of the information.
So if we don't get a piece of the funding, we're going to have to go back to the partners and say, do you want to continue this? And if they're not willing to put in extra money or to scale back the scope of the project, then it will go away. Or if this board's not willing to
come before the board again.
Well, yeah, we'll have to have a new agreement, new amounts, and all that.
Then after 2 years, assuming money and everything, everyone's happy, everyone signs on to everything, after 2 years when it's complete, is there ongoing maintenance and so on and so forth? Or we got the data, then that's all we need.
Yeah, for the most part, what's planned right now is we would not keep those gauges as continuous recording. We might consider, we have the one at Waterloo, like I described, if we keep the one right by the Platte River, which would be a well that we own, we might keep that for long-term records as well.
Thank you.
I'd like to know who initiated this. Where did the push for this come from?
I kind of initiated it, bringing up the idea, and then worked through Marlin and USGS to propose it.
And DNR was interested.
Okay.
Can I see another hand someplace? Director Teaser.
I find this rather interesting because if we're losing water in the Platte by valley and it's working its way into the Elkhorn going cross country, we're actually bypassing your MUD West well field job. And so, I mean, if we're losing that groundwater because the Elkhorn will enter the Platte below the well field. So I find that very interesting. And it's also kind of interesting to think that valley, which everybody thinks is basically the Platte River, but about two-thirds of the valley, actually, the city of Valley, drains through the Elkhorn, and the western third drains through the Platte. So I find that very interesting, and I see some value in this study.
Thanks. Director Bunn.
When we took contract bids for the integrated groundwater management plan, we had Olson Associates win that contract, and they were quite clear that to complete that entire program, their project, they had enough data, or there was enough data readily available for them without having to sink new wells. And they showed us maps of this same area, full of a dozen additional wells, all with telemetry and with real-time monitoring. So I guess my concern here is that we're creating new work when there's actually data available. I'm just not understanding why we can't model this, these projections using the existing available data from wells that are already.
Well, the
and the fact that this is probably the most monitored area in the entire state.
We do have a lot of those. In fact, the numbers you see on that map up there are wells that we monitor only twice a year. So we only go out there twice a year. And it's not really telling us anything about the picture of what happens in relation to water flow in the rivers. It's just giving us an indication that our aquifer is healthy and it's not necessarily losing, but it doesn't tell us how it's working necessarily. So that these continuous recorders, there currently are none in this area right now. MUD does have continuous recorders closer to their actual well field that they look at, and they're actually agreeing to provide that data to us as well. So we'll have more data, but it's not necessarily in this. We want to look at this particular line because it's where we have stream gauges on each end and can really relate it to what's going on in the river.
Okay. Any other questions? Do you want to add something?
I can maybe just add to that just a little bit. Paul, he wasn't here at the time. Maybe I'll ask Brian. He was here when we did the integrated management plan. But, yeah, that contract called for no new monitoring, no new groundwater models. I mean, we could have, but I think the concept was we'll use the data we have, and there's a lot of good data out there. But I think that IMP is involved in integrated water management plan came up with some 80 proposed actions in the future. And some of those actions, it may not have identified exactly this model, this investigation, but it said we would continue to develop models and tweak models and gather information in the future to enhance our knowledge of our groundwater and surface water systems. And that's what this is. So I think this is meeting the goals of that plan in that we further increase our knowledge and information on our groundwater.
Thank you. Is there any assumption in this that green line represents the direction of groundwater flow?
I'm going to say not necessarily. It's just a... What is the difference between those two gauges and the river? I think Chris acknowledged that we don't think it's exactly that path, but
so there was some work done by some folks in our office that they did one snapshot in time with some contours from a groundwater model. It's approximately in that direction. One of the portions of this project is to do kind of a water level survey where we took, you know, we go outside all the every well in that we can get our hands on in that particular green area. You measure the water level. You survey it in with a high-precision GPS. So you have all these different elevations, and now you can draw a contour map and figure out exactly where those flow directions are. Mm-hmm. And so part of that study is, so if we got high water in the Platte, how does that affect the groundwater flow directions? We got high water in the Elkhorn or an ice jam or something like that. How does that affect the dynamics of that system? Is it is there kind of seasonal changes to the groundwater flow direction or timing? So that's kind of one of the portions of the project, is kind of look at not just over time in one particular area, but also look at the entire study area as a whole at different snapshots in time.
The reason I ask, I think that line is approximately at right angles to the historic stream bed. You would have thought that there's a direction of flow, it would have been along the lines of the historic stream bed.
Well, I think the I think what the second figure does show is that there's by far the Platte River is really coming up through this stretch, and the Elkhorn River is continuing to stay, because imagine just a few miles downstream they come together at the same elevation. Mm-hmm. So the Platte River is really hiking up, and the Elkhorn River isn't. It's kind of staying on its course. And that's why we kind of have the gradient difference that we do, and that allows this aquifer to have that kind of characteristic.
Okay. Any other questions or comments?
The Platte River slope is about 5 feet per mile. The Elkhorn is about 2.5.
Right.
So that's why your Elkhorn
still runs downhill, doesn't it?
Yep.
Did I see another hand? Roll call on the motion.
Bennett?
Yes.
Teaser?
Yeah.
Thompson?
Yes.
Fowler?
Yes.
Shippers?
Yes. Thank you. Get back to the agenda here. Got to get the book.
Yep. Thanks.
John, I'm going to, before Thursday, have to talk to your story about how this data, before we vote on Thursday, would be included and folded into the integrated.
You're talking about John.
I don't know if we'll have it before it's completed. Didn't he just say that it was completed? Produced PD recommendations?
I had no, heard that this study would be completed before that.
You're ready to move along?
Yeah.
Okay. We're on item 11, review and recommendation on a water sustainability fund application for AEM Southwestern Sarpy County Dakota Aquifer Mapping Project. Paul Woodward again and Brian Hankel with FIRA. Welcome back.
Good evening again, and we have a long-distance traveler, Brian.
Both of you.
Brian has a lot of background on this subject. I'm going to just touch on a couple of the things. Our work in the past with ENRA has given us a lot of good data, and we've seen the capabilities of this. AEM stands for Airborne Electromagnetic Survey or mapping, and really what it's shown us in different places is just a few snapshots, really. I mean, we haven't got a complete picture of what's happening under the ground, but we know what it's doing along particular cross sections. If you go down to the first map, Mike, keep going down right there. In particular, look at the blue cross sections that kind of form a tic-toe pattern there, or tic-tac-toe pattern in the southwestern Sarpy County area. We looked at those in particular. Okay, that's these different lines here. This crosses the most of the county, and then these kind of form that area around Springfield. Kind of sits in the middle of the tic-tac-toe. What we learned in that location is that there is some good Dakota sandstone or Dakota aquifer that's available. If you go on to the next map real quick, Mike, just below that, this area is actually being used quite a bit as both for mostly domestic wells, as you might expect more acreages to occur in the area. There are a few public wells for Springfield and a couple other small subdivisions that are of interest to keep those actively going. And then there are parts of this aquifer that have enough capability to actually, the blue, light blue ones here are actual agricultural irrigation wells. So it does have quite a bit of capability. If you go down to the next map, Mike, this is a cross section. I don't know, we're going to kind of run out of that, but there you go. This is one of the one of those lines that we were showing that runs east to west. The other than the green, the color above the green is kind of the existing alluvium, mostly made up of silts, but also some sandy material. It's probably has fairly good recharge. And then we do see the green there then is the what they described as the Dakota sandstone. And one of the other, maybe hit this last map here real quick, Mike, on right below that. Sorry about all the rotation here, guys. In that southern Sarpy County area down here, we have over the long-term sampling, water quality sampling that we've seen, picked up several of our high nitrate readings in that area over time. So, and go back up to the top, to the memo. So what we're looking at doing, in order to give a full-blown picture of that area, is to do this aerial electromagnetic mapping or flights across that entire area in a pretty dense pattern. And what that would allow us to do, so let's say people are having problems in that area when it comes to nitrates or well problems between neighbors at some point in time. They can look at where their well falls. You know, we'll have a detailed, like 3D dimensional view of what that is and can make decisions about whether to drill their well deeper. They could look at constructing it in better ways. They could, we can learn a little bit more about the recharge, how much water is getting to that aquifer, and potentially where it's moving to based on the bottom of this then would be a limestone or shale bedrock. And then any water quantity issues that we had could be mapped where we get smaller, insufficient areas of the Dakota aquifer. Looking to do that, there are a lot of other NRDs from in our NRA group, and what was decided is that we wouldn't put in one big project. Everybody would put in for these small under $250,000 projects. So there are approximately five other or four other projects being looked at in other NRDs. These would all be funded not cost share funded through NRA, but funded at each local NRD if we get the water sustainability funds. Brian is here because he is actually actively working on helping us develop the grant through his working with FIRA. So be happy to. Do you have anything to add, Brian, on the details?
Maybe I'll just talk a little bit about the water quality aspects of it. So there was a fair amount of work that was done by the district previously in cooperation with USGS to look at the susceptibility of domestic wells in the area to surface water contamination, primarily looking at nitrates. And we did a bunch of sampling out there, and there seems to be a reasonably good correlation between the thickness of glacial materials that sits on top of the active aquifer that's being used and how susceptible it is. So the thinner the materials, the more susceptible it is. But what happens oftentimes, and everybody can understand this, is you're looking at well records. There's a driller that's out there, and you're paying that driller by the foot. And when they get enough aquifer material, they're going to stop. And you don't know where the bottom is. And so these wells are typically screened relatively close to the top because nobody's going to pay an extra however many dollars per foot to just find out where the bottom of the aquifer is. But this mapping project can find out where the bottom is. And so you'll have a suite
of options available to you that you wouldn't typically have by knowing those kind of characteristics about it. And so you may not be able to do something about the nitrates immediately, but you might be able to have different kinds of standards in particular areas where you're going to want drillers to go deeper in order to help keep the screens lower and get away from that susceptibility in some cases. And so you can make improvements pretty rapidly, and then you can make improvements over the long term as well by understanding where that water is moving through the system and where it's bringing surface contamination with it, and help those users in that area. So it's an area of real concern. There are people that have wells, there are a lot of wells that have gone in the last number of years, and there are some real nitrate problems in that area that need to be considered and some solutions provided. So,
I think at this point, we don't have a motion on the floor, do we?
No.
Chair had asked for a motion so we get into specific discussion.
Move staff recommendation. I'll second.
We have a motion and a second. Anyone else in the public wish to speak? Okay, it's up to back to you, directors. Then. Director Teaser.
Okay, is it possible that this aquifer is self-contained? It's not attached? Are we looking at just a bowl and possibly?
That's likely what it is in that particular area. There aren't alluvial aquifers like the Platte and Elkhorn. The Platte is adjacent, it's nearby, but it's not at the same elevation. There's the Dakota, which is essentially a remnant that the Platte has cut through the Dakota along that lower portion and probably cut through actually along the I-80 corridor as well. It isolated this lobe. The Missouri cut it over on the other side, and it's just sitting there by itself.
So the more the cows poop, the worse it's going to get.
Whether it's that or whether it's artificial or synthetic fertilizer, that there's ways to determine that too with some additional sampling that can be done. But yeah, source isn't known, but getting a handle on how is it getting in there is a big step in the right direction.
Isn't this going to have an impact on the potential for developable, making land developable for acreages? If the water quality is poor, people won't be able to get safe water. It'll stifle development.
It's variably poor, and where it is better, then you wouldn't have to worry about it quite so much. It depends on how much material is above it. But where it has the potential to allow for maybe some deeper wells where you have higher potential for that surface, because the stuff that would tend to stay on the upper portion of the aquifer,
right,
and not mix down. And so if you put the well in deeper and screened it appropriately, grouted it appropriately, then you could isolate yourself from it. And so that's part of what you'll get out of this, is hopefully a way to understand so that you're not so limited.
So then you could potentially identify sites where there's a better chance of getting a decent well in. Thank you. Other questions or comments? Roll call on the motion.
Peter?
Yes.
Thompson?
Yes.
Fowler?
Yes.
Burnett?
Yes.
Chairperson?
Yes. Thank you, gentlemen. Now, item 12, review and recommendations and changes to the district's policy manual. Marlon Peterman.
Good evening, directors. The might focus your attention to the memorandum. It'll be on the board and in your books there for our annual, I guess, look at policy manual changes here in December. We have just a few for you. The first segment, there are two policies that are in the 15 category. All policies in your policy manual from 1 through 15 require layover to the boards, layover to the following month, according to your policy. And so we'll cover those kind of in that group. And then we've got a number of program changes that you can adopt just at the action of one board meeting without laying them over. So the first two there in policies 15.4 and 15.8, the first being under emergency purchasing authority. Last year, when we dealt with the levee breach up in Dakota County on Pigeon Creek, you implemented this policy by which is to give emergency purchasing authority by the board, and actually can be by six board members, and it allows for a quick time to repair that levee breach in quick order. And your policy said to use the informal bidding procedure, and we did that so that we could just get contractors out there in a hurry, get informal bids within a day, and award a contractor and get that levee breach closed and repaired. What we found out, though, as we talked last year and dealt with that, was that there are two things that kind of limit that, in that the emergency purchasing authority, using interlocal, using that subsection in your manuals, provides for a dollar limitation of up to $30,000. Well, you can't do a lot for $30,000 when you're going to repair a levee breach. And so that was a limiting factor. And what you actually did was say, well, we exempt it from that requirement. The other limitation is that it specifies we have in other segments of your manual, it says for any time we have a contract, you have to have a bid bond for anything over $50,000 and a performance bond for anything over $25,000. And that can be a limiting factor, too, when you're out trying to get a job done and get a hole in the levee fixed up, that the contractors have to go search around and get bonds. And I'm not sure the contractor that we ended up using up there actually was one that had easy access to the bonds, and so that's a time waster as well. And so what we're recommending here is that you continue that policy, only that it exempts the provisions for the cost provision and the bonding requirement when we do that emergency purchasing authority. So it would basically say use informal bids without a cap on the dollars and without requiring the bonds. Now, of course, it still needs board approval ultimately of those, but that's a recommendation to help streamline that process and to fit it really to, I think, your policies and meet the objectives of what you're trying to do there. The second one is, I'll just cover that quick, 15.8, performance bonds. Currently, your policy says that performance bonds are required for projects over $25,000. We'd like to increase that to $50,000, a couple reasons. One is, and primarily, is to bring it up to the same level as bid bonds. You require that bid bonds, in other words, a bond that the contractor provides when he bids, is required for any project over $50,000. Well, it seems it would make it a lot easier for us, and I think more sense, if we had both the bid bonds and the performance bond then that they obtain be the same amount, $50,000, rather than being different amounts. It's just hard for us to explain sometimes, and hard to remember that we have different limits there, and so making them $50,000, making the performance bond equal what the bid bond is at $50,000, seems appropriate. We certainly think, of course, as time is going on here in inflation, that $50,000 doesn't get you a lot these days. And actually, trying to collect on a performance bond, we've had experience with that a few years back on a project, and you're probably going to spend more than $50,000. Well, I don't know, more than $50,000, but a lot of money trying to collect and get a contractor to and the bond company to enforce that bond, and hardly worth it for a $50,000 project. And it's probably just a lot better to go out and finish it yourself if the contractor isn't going to do it. So we're recommending that bond, the performance bond, be increased from $25,000 to $50,000 limit. I think maybe what we might do is why don't I go through the other policy manuals, and we do have two motions then that separate these out.
Go ahead, Marlon. Go ahead with the.
I'll go with the ones that, that could be 17 and on are program related. The well abandonment program, Terry Shoemaker is recommending that we increase the cost share there from 60 to 75% to more match our other cost share programs and our CAP, et cetera, and make it more consistent and also more encouragement to landowners to abandon their wells. This is really a very high issue on water quality that these wells be abandoned and be abandoned properly by licensed well drillers. So this would be an inducement for more of that to be done and matches then again with our other programs. The trail assistance program there, we've got a few house cleaning items, housekeeping items to kind of clean up that program a little bit and some clarifications. But the primary thing we're doing there is recommending you take out that provision for that the applicant must apply for federal transportation enhancement funding. Number one, there isn't any funding available, and number two, the hassle to go through that funding is not worth it, as we found out. And so that provision, we think, should be, and I think you've talked about that in the past, of striking that that provision. In fact, we've approved some projects with kind of striking that portion. So we're recommending you just adopt it in your policy that that not be a requirement. The last three, WP6, WP7, and Zerinsky Basin 2, is really just putting those policies in your policy manual, putting those projects in your policy manual. They're projects that are in your budget, and so that's just kind of a house cleaning and keeping item to insert those in the manual. And so our recommendation on these last five policies, 17, 32 through 18, 44, is that you approve those recommended changes. And those would not have to be carried over till next month. So we recommend their approval.
Okay, Chair would entertain a motion on the first bullet. If you're following along the agenda letter, it's 17.32, 40, 42, 43, and 44.
Move staff recommendation.
Is there a second? We have a second. Anyone in the public wish to speak to these? Seeing none, directors? Director Thompson.
When I first saw this about removing the trail assistance program with the leading the requirement of federal transportation enhancement funding, I thought, you know, we're going to give in to the people down in Lincoln who can't get trails awarded, trail dollars awarded. And I put in context, and sure enough, this is implementing what the reality is. And we aren't getting our transportation money from Lincoln. And it's unfortunate, since Senator Fisher sent a great memo saying, hey, Nebraska, you're $1.5 billion, I guess it was in the World Herald, however much coming to Nebraska, and applauding and all that. Plus, it's a trail system. Unfortunately, she doesn't understand that none of those dollars are being spent because of bureaucratic BS down in Lincoln, with the Federal Highway and the Department of Roads. We're the only state that requires a 40-page memo, and then they keep rejecting it. That's why no one applies for the dollars, including the other 22 NRDs. So I apologize. No, I don't apologize. Heck, I'm on a soapbox. But
you are on your soapbox.
It's unfortunate that we cannot use those federal transportation enhancement funding that Senator Fisher is so proud that Nebraska got. But we'll continue to amend this policy to get the trails built that need to be built in spite of the people on Federal Highway who can't get a dollar spent on this great program.
In that regard, we could always come back and amend the regulation again to require an application if, in fact, we see money becoming available. No. Any other questions or comments? Roll call on the motion, please.
Thompson?
Yes.
Fowler?
Yes.
Lawler?
Yes.
Bennett?
Yes.
Yes. Now moving on to the other management recommendation involving items 15.4 and 15.8. Someone care to make a motion?
Move staff recommendation.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Anyone in the public wish to speak? Directors? Seeing any no comments? I want to go back to something that Marlon mentioned, that difficulty of collecting on bonds. What was the last time we had anyone default on them that we lost any money on a performance?
It was on the Turtle Creek structure down here by Papillion. I don't know, 7-8 years ago, Martin might remember.
Yeah, 7 or 8.
Five. Yeah, at least 5 years ago. And we had a contractor there that just wasn't getting the job done, wasn't paying his subs, and so we finally went to collect on the bond to get him to pay the subs. And boy, legal counsel and Martin spent endless hours trying to get that accomplished. We ended up paying the subs is what we ended up doing. And it was just a real cluster.
You don't feel that having that leverage of the bond forces other contractors to perform and pay their bills?
Oh, I think it does. And it's necessary. It's just, I'm saying, for small projects, under $50,000, really don't think it's realistic.
Any other questions or comments? Roll call, please.
Fowler?
Yes.
Bennett?
Yes.
Teaser?
Yes.
Thompson?
Yes.
Chairperson?
Yes. Thanks. Two more. 13. Okay. Item 13, review and recommendation on providing notice of breach and authority to terminate the water purchase agreement with the City of Fort Calhoun. Zach Nelson, please.
Good evening. Just before I get started, I want to let all of you know that the mayor of Fort Calhoun, as well as Fort Calhoun's legal counsel, is here. So I'd say behave.
Let me interrupt you for just a minute. At some point, we may be going into executive session. I'll wait for a sign from you, Mr. Newman, at the appropriate time.
Okay.
Yes, sir. Go ahead,
sir. Okay. Thank you. So as you all know, on May 20th, 1978, the district and city of Fort Calhoun executed an agreement for the sale of water from the district to the city, thus forming the Washington County Rural Water System. Since then, the agreement's been amended 4 times, mainly just to update project costs for the original construction of the system and to update quantities, pressures, as well as just change the duration of the agreement. When the system was originally designed, it was pretty much just a straight shot from North 60th Street, from our pump station all the way up to Fort Calhoun. That system was dependent on a fully functioning water tower within the city of Fort Calhoun. The main purpose for that is to level off peak demands. Essentially, when a water tower is there, you pump water to it during the night when energy costs are cheap, as well as when demand's low. During the day when demand increases, the water tower helps keep that pump from running continuously. Over the course of the last few years, the city's water tower has fallen into disrepair and is not functionable at this time. The specific agreement outlines the responsibilities of the district as well as of the city to maintain certain components of that system. Under the agreement, the city was responsible for maintaining that water tower. As a result, they have not maintained it, thus breaching the contract. Myself and legal counsel, as well as management, feels it's in the best interest of the water system and the district to proceed forward with the termination clause of the water purchase agreement with the city of Fort Calhoun. I want to stress and reiterate, this does not mean that water is getting shut off. This does not mean that water quality is changing, pressure is changing, quantity, anything is changing. This is just simply saying that the agreement has been breached. It is causing a strain on the system, obviously mechanically with the pumps running, increased energy costs, as well as just a financial strain of there is litigation ongoing right now. I'd be open to entertain any questions that you may have at this point.
Mr. Newman, do you feel we should go into executive session before we put a motion on the floor?
If the would please the board, if they would like to ask questions concerning how this may impact the pending litigation with Fort Calhoun, I would be more free to answer those questions and address the board in executive session as opposed to open session.
All right. Is there agreement to go into executive session?
I'm moving to be going to executive session to discuss the water situation with Fort Calhoun.
Is there a second?
Okay.
Discussion?
I'm in that pending litigation. Why part of that motion? You should state pending litigation.
Mr. Teaser, your motion should also mention the discussion of pending litigation. Mr. Teaser, did you hear that?
The pending litigation as an add-on to the motion.
All right. Roll call on the motion, please.
Point of clarification. Apologize, Director, but since the motion was revised, I would need a new second.
Thank you. Who seconded the original motion?
Mr. Fowler.
I did.
Would you second the amendment?
I will.
Thank you. Roll call, please.
Burnett?
Yes.
Teaser?
Yes.
Thompson?
Yes.
Fowler?
Yes.
And Shippers?
Yes. Is there any, before we go into executive session, is there anything else we need to do, Mr. Newman?
No, sir.
Okay, thank you. We'll ask that the public. I'm just waiting for him to come in so they can see us. Chair, entertain a motion to go back into open session.
So move.
Roll call, please.
Teaser?
Yes.
Thompson?
Yes.
Fowler?
Yes.
Burnett?
Yes.
And John?
Yes. We got to get to the agenda item here. Do we have a motion on the floor?
No.
Chair to entertain a motion for.
I move staff recommendation.
Is there a second?
Second.
The motion and the second. For the benefit of the audience, I'm going to read it. The staff recommends, the subcommittee recommended the board, the general manager be authorized to purport Fort Calhoun and the USDA written notice of the city's material breach of the Fort Calhoun water purchase agreement dated May 20th, 1978. And its subsequent amendments, and that the general manager be further authorized to terminate the agreement should Fort Calhoun not cure the breach within 60 days of receiving said notice. Is there anyone in the public that would like to speak to this? Is the mayor or your attorney or anyone else want to address the board? Okay. Anyone in the public wish to speak to this? Before we vote on this, I want to emphasize that while we are a board of directors, directors are not individually authorized to negotiate or get involved in any way in the legal matters between the NRD and the city of Fort Calhoun or any other agency. And this is a matter that our legal the dealings will be through our legal staff and our general manager. And no one else has any authority to speak or on behalf of the board. Roll call on the
I
motion.
Have a question.
Go ahead.
For Zach. Can we be provided by the Thursday's board meeting with the agreements that this allegation that the city has to maintain its water tower? Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Anything else, anybody else? Roll call on the motion, please.
Thompson?
Yes.
Ballard?
Yes.
Burnett?
Yes.
Caesar?
Yes.
Jefferson?
Yes. Report the vote, please.
5 yeas, 0 nays.
Thank you. Now, item 14 is review and recommendation on the bid opening for the Washington County Rural Water Snowdrift Lane Water Main Extension. Zach Nelson, please.
Thank you. In November, the district was contacted by John and Nicole Trevis. They live in northern Douglas County, pretty close to the Washington County border. Their current well is starting to fail and is down to producing around a gallon per minute. They have a large household of children, so obviously that's an issue. The closest water main to the Trevis property is located at the intersection of Hawkwood Circle and 42nd Street. You go to that map for me, please. And if you could rotate it to the left, please, counterclockwise. So kind of the upper corner there, you see there's a note that says existing 6-inch main. So it's from this point we would connect our existing infrastructure, run a 3-inch line parallel to 42nd Street, and then head west on Snowdrift Lane to just in front of the Trevis property. Under the proposed agreement, the Trevises would be treated similar as any other potential customer on our system, as well as developer, where they are responsible for 100% of the costs for engineering fees and construction of the extension to serve them. Following the meeting with the Trevises and kind of going to anticipated contractor pricing, we move forward with seeking informal bids. Right now, the market for this type of work is really saturated. Over 9 contractors were contacted. We got 4 bids. And Hinton Trenching out of Blair provided a low bid of $37,988, which is consistent with where we were anticipating the bids to come in at. Just slightly over, I believe HDR's estimate was a little over $35,000 for the work. We have a longstanding relationship with Hinton Trenching. They've worked on other projects for us before, so the engineer and myself believe they're qualified to perform the work. So since the low bid is over $30,000, I'm asking for staff or for board approval to move forward with executing this agreement with Hinton Trenching.
Okay, let's chair to entertain a motion on this. Thank you, Director Teaser. Is there a second?
I'll second that.
Second by Director Bonnet. Anyone in the public wish to speak? Directors? Director Jaff.
Wouldn't this be considered in adding on to the IPA?
This particular area, we have lines that are further south of this point.
Yes.
So it's no different than, we get, like I said earlier, I think we've had 78 new customers since 2013. We have little main extensions all the time.
It's in the IPA boundary.
Yeah.
It's what?
It's in the IPA boundary. It's just a service connect.
If this had been within management's authority, we wouldn't, dollar wise, we wouldn't even be discussing it.
Yeah.
It's more expensive.
Yeah, there's lines further south in Douglas County than where this is at, and lines further east. So if you were to draw like a bubble around this, like Hawk Woods, that extends further south, and then there's north. I'm trying to think, the North Omaha Airport has a bunch of lines around it as well.
So my question is: Is it in the boundaries?
Correct.
Why aren't we adding a service line instead of a main line? The surface line's what? The maximum is, an inch and a half?
It depends on the property. I mean, if you have an acreage that's sitting really far off from a main, it could be as big as a 2-inch. The reason why this is an actual main is because 42nd Street, there's the potential down the road for future customers to hook onto that.
So this is a future main extension.
Yeah, call it a main extension.
My suggestion is in statute 3252, the existing boundary project areas may be altered and the project may be authorized after a hearing by the board upon a motion by the board or petitioners. So why don't we have a public hearing?
The boundary's not being extended.
The boundary's not being.
And it's within the boundary. Like a football field, we're within the 20s and the 50s.
Well, then you can only be in the boundaries if you're on the line. We're connecting a main line. That's why I asked the question, was this a service? And then the answer is no. We're adding a main line for other people to hook on at a later date.
Director Jeff, I'm very familiar with that statute.
Okay.
The last subject. And there's nothing, but the service line and the main line, there's no distinguishment between the types of lines within 3250, 2, 3, or 4.
Uh-huh.
So whether it's service or main line doesn't have any impact on the statute. The statute is governed by whether it's you're extending the boundaries. This is within the boundaries, and there's no need to go through the process up in 3250.
Okay.
I'd like to comment. I noticed in the checks that I signed tonight, it was one to our attorneys. They had just a few dollars less than $1,000 legal fees involved relating to this main extension. I would hope that those fees will be collected as well as the...
That is correct.
Thank you.
In escrow, yeah. So prior to the way...
Well, I'm not worried about escrow. Yeah. He cut on my back. He's a good guy. No, but I think he ought to pay the full boat. That's what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Any other comments? Roll call on the motion, please.
Fowler?
Yes.
Burnett?
Yes.
Caesar?
Yes.
Thompson?
Yes.
Jefferson?
Yes. That concludes our agenda. We are adjourned. Thank you all.
We'll take a 5-minute recess before we reconvene. Time is 8:33. And we'll call the FEL subcommittee meeting to order. As previously stated, the Open Meetings Act is posted in the back of the meeting room. With that, form call.
John Conley.
Here.
Ross.
Yeah.
Will.
Here.
Thompson.
Here.
And
here. Adoption of the agenda.
So moved.
Roll call. Thompson seconded. Director Thompson, thank you.
Ross.
Yeah.
John Conley.
Yes.
Whittle.
Yes.
Thompson.
Yes.
And Shepard.
Yes. I have before me proof of publication of this meeting. Moving on to item 6, review and recommendation of fiscal year 2015 audit, Kerry Fry and Jane from HSMC. All right. Good evening, guys and gals.
Good evening. We went through the fairly detailed review of the audit last month, and Kerry and I are here to answer any questions that you might have or any follow-up questions. I think we've provided information that was requested at the last public hearing. So,
anybody have any questions? Director Jeff. Do we get a motion on the floor to
approve approval of staff recommendation?
So a second?
Second.
Anybody in the audience wish to speak to the issue? The young director?
I don't know if it's an audit question, but I'm, as a director, I'm provided with a W-2 form. Why am I provided with a W-2 form? Because I'm not an employee instead of a 1099?
Do you want to answer that?
Somewhere in the notes in the file, we have a memo about that from many, many years ago.
Speak up.
The per diem and taxable expenses are subject to employment taxes, Social Security, and Medicare. I mean, we can look up the statute. I don't know off the top of my head.
Could I have you provide it with that?
Sure.
Yeah, I don't have the specific IRS regulations that govern that, but I'll help Carrie get that to you.
I think the question was whether it's on the right form or not. Is that
correct?
Is that the nature of the question?
Yes.
Okay. Any other questions for directors? Seeing none, roll call.
Thompson.
Yes.
Woodle.
Yes.
Ross.
Yeah.
John Conley.
Yes.
And Chairperson.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Item 7, reviewing recommendation of the Elk River 243 Bank Stabilization Project, Long-Term Solution, Right-of-Way Acquisition. Eric Williams and Jack Burmeyer with Midwest Right-of-Way. Good evening.
Good evening, just Eric Williams. Jack is not here. It didn't seem like he would be needed this evening. We'd put him on, but didn't invite him out this evening. This is Elkhorn River 240th Street. We talked about it last month, and we have an additional track. Do you have the map available? There are only three. Last month was track three. This month is track one. This one includes another channel easement for the area of the proposed new channel. Do you have a paper copy of the map in front of you? Directors, just want to make sure I'm not skipping around. Okay, so yeah, track one in the upper left there. The large curved shaded area is the area of the channel, and then the small straight area is an access easement. I believe it's 50 feet wide. That would be long-term access for the district in the event that maintenance were needed along this section of the channel, and that connects over to 245th Street. Negotiations have concluded on this. It's 12.37 acres for the channel easement, 0.686 acres for the access easement. The recommendation is for $117,000 for the combination of the two easements.
We get a motion on the floor?
So moved.
And a second?
Second.
Thank you. Anybody in the general public wish to make comments? Director, Treasurer Jeff.
Is this part of the school land section?
This is not.
Okay. Are you aware that the school land section went up for lease on the 4th of December?
It was posted. The lease auction was today. Okay. Marlon and I did attend, and we will have additional information about that in the future.
Okay.
Any further questions? Roll call.
John Conley.
Yes.
Woodall.
Yes.
Ross.
Yeah.
Thompson.
Yes.
And Chairperson.
Yes. Thank you.
Mr.
Item 8, review the recommendation of the King Lake buyout permit.
We do need to collect, and the legal counsel just reminded me, the page out of your, that has that table of acres and values, we really need to collect that from you. Thank you. We'll get you a new one in there without that table.
Don't worry about it.
I don't mind this one.
Thank you very much.
Right. I'm working off of this, so you find it in there.
Okay.
Now, just note to the directors, you have access to that. That is a privileged document, so we request that it not be disclosed outside the court.
Okay, item number 8, review recommendation of King Lake buyout.
Okay.
Lori?
Can you go to the map, please? So we have what will be the final three purchases for the current grant that we have through FEMA for the King Lake buyout program. We have two residential properties, 24115 Lakeside Place, which appraised at $5,000. 24235 King Lakeside Drive, which appraised at $8,000. They're owned by the same person, and he did accept the appraised value. And then we have 24535 King Lake Road, which is the bar as you go into King Lake that has been closed for a number of years, and it is under a demolition order by the City of Omaha, so it kind of, there's several people here that have the same goal. It appraised at $40,000, and the owner has accepted. And if you have any questions, I can answer.
I move approval of staff recommendation.
Second. Anybody from the general public wish to comment? Directors? Director Frost?
It's under order C, Molly.
Mm-hmm.
What big value?
Well, it's not going to be demolished, is the short answer. This kind of all worked together when it flooded in 2010. That's where our grant funds came from. And the only reason that has not been enforced is that we did have this this program, this buyout program, so the city has not really enforced that at this time. It is a repairable structure. I mean, it could have been repaired. It is not in the floodway. It is in the flood fringe, so there's no regulations preventing it from being repaired and flooded in the future. So that's really the main goal, is that we would rather see that out of there rather than have the owner go in, make those repairs, make it a usable structure again, and have it flooded again in the future.
Didn't you just say that the city wanted it demolished?
It was damaged in the 2010 flood, yes. To be honest, almost all of them that we have purchased were under that order at some point in time.
And this program expires this month?
Yes, I have to have this closed and demolished by the 25th of December. So you'll see the next agenda item for that.
Okay.
Further questions? Roll call.
John Collins.
Yes.
Frost.
Yeah.
Woodall.
Yes.
Thompson.
No.
And Chairperson.
Yes. Thank you. Item 8B, review and recommendation of King Lake agreement with Waterloo Volunteer Fire Department.
Okay. So as I mentioned earlier, I do have to have these structures demolished by December 25th. That is the end of my period of performance, as FEMA calls it. So I cannot expend any more, any funds that I would expend after that point in time would not be reimbursable. And I do have to have the properties cleared. That is a requirement of the grant. The Waterloo Volunteer Fire Department has requested to use these structures for a training exercise. And they are able to get a permit from the state fire marshal to burn them down. Then we just kind of pick up the rubble and it's a little bit quicker. However, we do have a waiver, release, and hold harmless agreement that legal counsel has recommended we sign with the fire department, just saying anything that happens during those training exercises, we are not liable if there's injuries or anything.
Can we get more time for a plate?
So moved.
In a second. Director Frost. Comment from the public. Comment from directors. Roll call.
Frost.
Yeah.
John Conley.
Yes.
Thompson.
Yes.
Woodall.
Yes.
And Chairperson.
Yes. Item number 9.
Oh, yeah.
Happy Creek Watershed PL 566, structure number W3, John Camden Family Trust, right-of-way acquisition, Washington County Court Board of Appraisals Award. At this time, Director Japp, I'm going to ask you to leave the room. As chairman of the committee, I request that you do leave the room during the committee's discussion in executive session of the W3 project. We will be getting a motion here momentarily to go into executive session. And Director Zapp, you have previously testified on behalf of Mr. Camden, and during that testimony revealed what was discussed during an executive session. Therefore, to allow the committee to receive legal counsel's consultation without concerns of any privileged matters being unilaterally waived by Director, or by you, Director Zapp, I request that you remove yourself from this room.
I deny.
At that point, under advice of legal counsel, I will ask the sheriff deputy to remove you.
Okay.
It's sure funny, isn't it? He's grinning.
Can we, at this time, get a motion to go into executive session?
I move to go into executive session, discuss Watershed PL566 Structure W3.
Is there a second?
Yes.
Roll call.
Frost.
Yeah.
Woodle.
Yes.
John Conley.
Yes.
Thompson.
Yes.
And Jeffers.
Yes. At this time, we will go into the executive session.
So moved.
I make a second.
And can we get a roll call to go out of the executive at this point, please?
Motion? I thought you just had one.
No.
Go ahead.
John Conley.
Yes.
Frost.
What was that? I just didn't hear.
Come out of the
coming out of the executive session.
Yeah.
Poodle.
Yes.
Thompson.
Yes.
And Chipper.
Yes. Is there a motion? Does anybody care to make staff recommendation?
I move approval of staff recommendation for item 9A as written.
Is there a second?
Second.
Director Thompson. Discussion from the general public. Discussion from the directors. Director Jab.
Was there, in the last go around, since this NRD was found in court not to negotiate in good faith, was there offers and counteroffers given?
There was a proposal for a settlement. Yes.
If there has, why weren't they ever been brought to this board before?
If there was, let me rephrase it. There were offers made, Mr. Camden.
By who? To who? Mr. Camden made an offer, or did we make an offer?
Management of NRD.
Made an offer.
Made a proposal.
Okay.
Not a formal offer.
All right.
In the sense of the legal term offer, but
okay.
Proposal.
And I assume Mr. Camden made an offer or a counteroffer?
What time frame are you talking?
Well, between your offer and today.
There's several different aspects that have occurred between that time and now.
All right.
Including the Board of Appraisers' decision rendered on approximately 25 days.
Uh-huh. So, before the Board of Appraisers, $172,000 offer or appraisal, did the Camden make a counter offer to the NRD?
No.
Okay.
Any other questions? Director?
Did they ever make a proposal to the NRD?
Director's out. Direct the question to me and
Did the Camdens ever gave an offer or proposal or any some kind of a settlement before this $172,000 appraisal was given by the Board of Appraisers?
You're talking about from the reinstitution of the negotiations following the Court of Appeals decision.
Which would have been more than a year ago.
From that point in time until the Board of Appraisers.
So what was your first part? Since I know when the appraisers get, what was the first part of your question?
I didn't ask a question.
Your answer then.
From the point in time when the Nebraska Court of Appeals through the business.
Okay. Right, that would have been more than a year ago.
Yes. Until Board of Appraisers issued its decision. That is before the board of this board of directors at this point. No.
Okay.
Further questions? Seeing a roll call.
John Conley.
Yes.
Rudolph.
Yes.
Thompson.
Yes.
Ross.
Abstain.
Yes. Item 9B, Hammond proposal.
Yes, can you go to the second memo, Mike? It's after the first one that has the Court of Appraisers, Board of Appraisers Award. Okay. Yeah, scroll down to this first page. Just go back to where you were just at. Right there is fine, probably. In September, Camden and his council met with district staff and our council to discuss his proposal for settling easement negotiations. There's a list of his proposal, which is on the screen there. What he proposed to do is that we would fill in the auxiliary spillway of the dam, which is the overflow spillway for flood flows, with soil removed from the top of the dam or supplied from an off-site location. Move the auxiliary spillway from the south end of the dam to the center of the dam with a weir structure. He suggested the idea of either a concrete structure like ZB1, Sierinski Basin 1, or a riprap chute. Straighten the dog leg of the southwest portion of the dam to allow them to farm the 6 acres of the auxiliary spillway. He would be willing to do the dirt work at no cost to the district. I mean, he's down the list here. Number 5, district would be granted an access easement along the south fence line as revised. Original dam easement would remain in place. So the original dam, before the dam was modified, that easement would remain in place. Can be revised to allow construction of home sites with walkout basements in the north end, the original easement, and the east and south end of the pond area. Number 6, changes to the dam site would be in lieu of any damages sustained by Mr. Camden. And number 7, the district would be required to pay his attorney fees. So those were, his letter is actually in the attachment today, but this is a summary of the things that he actually proposed. A little bit of background on the dam, and then I'll give you kind of the district staff take on those proposals. First of all, this project was initiated in 2003 after NRCS determined that breach route would actually impact a house, farmland, and Highway 30. And so after that, there was multiple agreements with the NRCS to for planning, engineering, and also rehabilitation of this structure. This extended from 2005 to 2009, and of course the structure was built in 2010. During this process of design, the NRCS did make some changes to try to satisfy the owner at the cost of $27,000. That included lowering the drawdown elevation and moving the auxiliary spillway to the opposite end of the dam from where it was originally located. At the time, the NRCS spent about roughly $350,000 in design of the structure and planning. We spent over $100,000 in staff time. Construction cost is $787,000. Overall project cost to date without land rights is about $1.2 million, roughly. A summary of his proposal is below and next page. If you scroll up a little bit, there you go. Number 1, to fill an auxiliary spill with off-site soil to return the area to farming would cost about $85,000. This is based upon what it cost to do the work back when we built this in 2010. If some of the material is removed from the dam and Mr. Cannon assisted the earth moving, the cost would be lowered, possibly to $70,000. This is a real rough cost estimate on our part. Number 2, to move the auxiliary spillway to the center of the dam and use riprap as he proposed, He said it would cost about $32,000 for materials. To build the Zirinsky Basin number one type concrete chute, actually Lambert Weir, would cost about $400,000. That's actually the number for the construction of ZB1, just the Weir, not anything else, just the Weir cost. And it's district staff opinion that riprap chute would not be allowed by DNR based upon the emails that we received back from them in the letters. So it'd be probably a Weir would be the requirement. You'd have to basically pass all the flow through the center of the dam. There wouldn't be any place else to go with it, so it's got to be a real hardened structure. It can't just be a riprap that's dumped in there. Below, there's a list of the things that the NRCS listed in the DNR. Extensive engineering planning and permitting effort would be required to modify the dam. Not unreasonable to expect this to cost about $400,000. New permits are required from the Corps, DNR, and DEQ. The NRCS NRD project agreement would have to be modified due to project changes. We'd have to possibly repay up to $1.3 million in NRCS investment in this structure, or some percentage of it, but it's going to be, that's the maximum probably. The proposed modification would require additional staff time again, roughly $100,000. We think it could cost up to $100,000, up to $1 million plus possible repayments to NRCS to accomplish the proposed modified project, which Mr. Camden has suggested. As with anything is possible, but it would take a lot of time, a lot of money, and a lot of effort to accomplish it. And I guess it's our opinion that it would be best not to do this. So that's our recommendations from staff.
You have a recommendation from staff that this committee recommends to the board that the Camden October 5th, 2015, written proposal for modifying the Pavilion Creek watershed PL 556 structure W3 be rejected. Do I hear Mr. Conley moving it? Is there a second?
I move approval.
Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you, Director Thompson. Discussion from the general public. Director
Zach. I have a question for our attorney. This October 5th letter that's provided from here, why wouldn't you consider that a counteroffer to the question I just previously asked you?
Director, you had the question, right? That's why I clarified the timing.
Okay.
The letter that was from October, that was following Board of Appraisers as indicated in Mr. Cleveland's memo. That was after the development report, correct? Or excuse me, Board of Appraisers.
The Board of Appraisers didn't get back with us until approximately a month ago, as you said.
Yes, but the hearing was held well before that.
So you would have received this letter before the Board of Appraisers?
No.
Before they...
The hearing on the Board of Appraisers, before the Board of Appraisers was for to receive Mr. Cannon's book for the October meeting as referenced in the
minute. All right.
So, hearing already.
Okay. So there was no negotiations after the Board of Appraisal hearing?
That's what's for you now.
Okay, so
the only proposal that we received.
All right.
From Mr. Cannon.
So why did it take 2 months before this board saw it? Why wasn't it brought to the board at the October board meeting or the November board meeting?
I believe it's in conjunction with management and then it's together as our duration of the project.
Yeah.
Question. Roll call.
Ross.
Abstain.
John Connolly.
Yes.
Woodall.
Yes.
Thompson.
Yes.
And Chilverson.
Yes. I have 9C. Martin.
Okay. Count 01035904392, which is maintenance of dams, attorney fees. has exceeded, will exceed, I guess, the 110% as of this, as of October, I guess. It would be November is when we made that, well, it should be this month, I think, if it carries around. But this month, we're actually going to be going over 110% if you approve this. We're at $22,115.61, budget $20,000, expecting, I guess, maybe a little less effort than what actually has occurred. We're not done yet for the year. I think you easily could expect it to maybe, I don't know if double would be the number, but it could be certainly another $10,000 or more. It depends on whether we get into court with Mr. Camden this next 6 months or not. So a lot of ifs, but nevertheless, we encourage you to allow us to exceed 110% of the budgeted number for this account.
Can I get a motion on the floor to exceed the 110%?
Staff recommendation.
Staff recommendation, Director Thompson. Who's second?
Second.
Director Connolly. Anybody in the general public wish to comment? Directors? Hearing none? Roll call.
John Connolly.
Yes.
Frost.
Okay.
Woodle.
Yes.
Thompson.
Yes.
And chairperson.
Yes. The time is 9:12. Is there a motion to adjourn?
Don't move.
You can adjourn, Chairman.
We do that by acclamation.
Mr. Newman, is Belmont the attorney? Is he a guy about my age?
Just the front page.
No. Belmont, is he a guy about my age?
No.